Mankind has always been fascinated by the passage of time, by the stages of life. Since the dawn of human consciousness, men and women have noticed the various stages of life. Infancy, youth, the fullness of maturity, and age. Indeed, in almost every language, the names which we use to describe the stages of life come originally from very descriptive terms which describe exactly the physical condition of a person during that stage. In Hebrew, tinok, an infant, describes one who is in the act of nursing, a nursling. And gadol, an adult, comes from the root of full height, a person who has attained the fullness of his stature. In English, the noun child comes from an old Germanic root which means womb-like. And the word adult is the past participle of the Latin verb which means to grow. It means to be fully grown, to have grown up. And when in more recent times we wanted to create a noun which would describe the period of rapid growth in the teens, we created the word adolescent from the same Latin root, which is the present participle, which means in the act of growing, in the act of becoming adult. Now, mankind is curious, and of course we're observant, and was not long after we observed the various stages of growth. We grow up and we grow down. Childhood, the period of growth; adulthood, the period of fullness of one's stature; age, the period of the bending, the growing down. Man began to associate certain psychological or emotional characteristics with these various stages. We find in the Bible, for instance, in the prophet Joel, the very astute observation, very true observation, with which he compares the daydreaming of the elderly with the youthful vision of the young. Ziknechem chalomot yechalomun. Your old men shall dream dreams. Bachurechem chezyonot yerau. While your young men shall see the compelling vision. Philosophers, and poets, and playwrights, and teachers have for centuries now tried to draw together their own impressions of the various stages of human life. Perhaps the most famous of them all, of course, is Shakespeare's famous Seven Stages of Life, which he puts into the mouth of a certain Duke Jacques in As You Like It. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first, the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, and then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face creeping like snail unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like furnace with a woeful ballad made to his mistress's eyebrows. Then a soldier full of strange oaths and bearded like the par, jealous in honor and sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bauble reputation, even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice in fair round belly with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard a formal cut full of wise saws and modern instances. And so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacle on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all that ends this strange eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. Now, something very vivid in this series of seven images, vivid and full of color and verve. But it's interesting to recognize that this is simply an impression. It's what the various stages of life look to us as if they were from the outside, as we see them in a sense in others, rather than what we feel within ourselves. Before we move on to adulthood and to the subject of the morning, I'd like to compare, just for an instant, a bit rabbinically, this soliloquy of Shakespeare's with a division of life into various stages. It was written some 1,400 years before As You Like It by a Tanna, a Palestinian teacher of the second century of the Common Era, by the name of Judah ben Tema. This particular division, it's in 14 stages, appears in the Pirkei Avot, the Sayings of the Fathers, an ethical treatise within the Mishnah. We know very little about Judah ben Tema. He lived at about the time of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. He was a preacher, more than a teacher, but a scholar of some note. And this is the way he divided life. At 5, the age is reached for the study of Scripture. At 10, for the study of Mishnah. At 13, one falls under the obligation of the mitzvot, of the commandments. At 15, the age is reached for the study of Talmud. At 18, for marriage. At 20, for seeking a livelihood. At 30, for full strength. 40 is the age of understanding, and 50, for the giving of counsel. At 60, a man attains age. At 70, white hair. At 80, rare old age. At 90, he is bending over, approaching the grave. And at 100, he is as if he were already dead and had passed away from the world. Now, it's interesting to compare Judah ben Tema and Shakespeare. In Shakespeare, it's a whining schoolboy, you know, making like a snail, crawling slowly towards school. In the Jewish tradition, youth is the time in which the teacher tries to cram down learning. 5, Bible, 10, the Mishnah, 15, the Talmud. The whole emphasis is on the intellectual capacity and achievements possible of the young. School in one is treated rather offhandedly, and the other is obviously the center of the culture, the religious life. It's interesting to compare their attitudes towards love and romance. Shakespeare treats romance rather offhandedly, but fully. The youth panting like a furnace, composing a ballad to the eyebrow of his mistress. The rabbi says simply, Shmona Esre L'chupa. 18 is the time for marriage, to go under the chuppah. And it says something about the rather unromantic way in which over the years marriage brokers and families arranged the relationships between man and woman. And they didn't do so badly over the years. You won't find many ballads in the Jewish tradition to a mistress's eyebrow, but you'll find a fine record of family and family attainment. And notice also the difference in the attitude towards age. Shakespeare sees the shrunken shank. He sees the withering. He sees the weazening of the features. And the Hebrew tries to maintain the dignity of age as long as he can. 60 is the age, is of age, and 70 is the time of white hair, and 80 is the fullness of the strength of age. It's only at 90 that really the wizened hand of death intrudes, and we become something much less than we've ever been. But whether we deal with Judah ben Tema and our culture, or by Shakespeare and the Elizabethan culture, we recognize that these attitudes towards the stages of life are impressionistic, they're exterior, there's no methodology to them, there's no considered scientific approach which would help us understand the commonality of the stages, when all of us, in a sense, go through these various stages. All that had to await to the century, to the development of that study which is called human development, when we began to recognize for the first time that there are patterns to human behavior, patterns to the development of personality, to the crises of personality, quite as much as their patterns of growth, physical growth. We began to blend together the study of the human physiology and the study of the human psyche, anatomy and medicine and psychology, psychiatry. We began to come up with a developmental picture of man, of woman, a picture of the various stages of life which we go through not only as they seem to others, the physical, the gross characteristics of change, but as they seem to us from within, the things that affect us, the emotions, the fears, the anxieties, the tensions, the sense of possibility, the hope, the thrusting out, all the emotions that any human being feels as he goes through the various stages of his life, if he's allowed all of these stages. It's interesting to ponder for a moment how this whole approach to human development was undertaken. The first serious study was undertaken of children, child development. Parents of my generation were really the first generation of parents to have the possibility of raising children by the book. Now, the book wasn't the Bible. It was the book of the Gazelle Institute or of Dr. Spock. But what it was really a first setting down by physicians and psychiatrists, by those who observed infancy and childhood, of the patterns of growth and the patterns of behavior, what we could presumably expect as we watched our children grow. When we saw normal patterns of behavior, what were abnormal patterns of behavior for a particular age, and presumably insight as to how we should manage our children in the process of their growing up. Now, it's fascinating to speculate as to why that generation of parents was so dependent upon the books. Was it, as I believe, largely the fact that there was so much change in our world? We had been raised still in a world where families were much as they'd always been, and where our parents were confident that the world would largely be as it had been. And we were raising our children into a world of future shock, full of change. We were uncertain. The patterns had broken down and the habits had frayed. There's no sense of continuity anymore. And we needed some sense, some measure, some sense of the parameters in which we should raise our children, and these books provided it for us. Was it perhaps that we recognized that the institutions which dealt with children, and the professionals, the teachers, the social workers, the counselors, the physicians, all of us needed, some guidance as to treating children as if they were something unique to themselves and not simply small adults, with needs, emotional needs particularly, that were special to them. And these new studies in child development provided that kind of insight. Whatever the reason for the sudden growth of this field, these books appeared, and we learned that it was not so unusual when our darling little infant of two became the terror that he became at 2.5, or when that model child of 5 grew into the explosive child of 6. And I suppose in that sense, all of this was helpful. But in the deeper sense, what we came to recognize as we read through these books about children was that for human beings generally, there were patterns of behavior. We all share a common destiny. That is, we are all alive and go through various changes within, changes that affect us very deeply. And one can, if not with the accuracy, the chronological accuracy which we can study children, one can, in a sense, plot the various spaces of life during which adults and the elderly go through certain basic changes and trauma and challenges. And about 10 years or 15 years after the first explosion of publication of knowledge in the child development theory field occurred, we began to study second childhood, the other end of the spectrum. Again, there were institutions which required for their programming and for their professionals very specific knowledge as to what age consists of. And gradually we discovered that this age essentially has three parts to it. There's the world of the elderly, there's the world of the senescent, and there's the world of the senile. And we began to recognize that each of these various stages, though they can come, say 15, 20 years apart in an individual's life, they come inevitably to the individual with certain blunting of the senses, with certain diminutions of power, with certain loss of immediate recall, with all kinds of changes taking place. And that when we face the emotional and psychological and human relationships that are involved as we go through these stages, we have only a certain set of strengths, of talents, and of abilities in which to draw. And as we began to study the elderly, we came to recognize that as we began to slow down, as our senses became to a certain degree blurred and indistinct, not as sharp as they'd once been, as our world turned in on itself and we began to doze often during the day and to sleep very little or erratically during the night, we began to recognize that most adults came to share a simple problem. And the problem was this, the problem of time. We were no longer, due to retirement or to the growth and maturity of our children, we were no longer filled with the things with which we are busied during most of our lives. Time lay heavy on our hands. And for many, the so-called easy years proved to be difficult years indeed, years of terrible frustration. Because many of the skills which had made for successful adjustment and success in life during the vigorous years, the years of adulthood, were skills which were no longer called for. The high energy, quotient man, full of drive, decisive in his ways, who had lived a world within himself, driven himself throughout life, suddenly finds himself in retirement, around people moving much more slowly than he's accustomed to move, among people who are impatient when he tries to organize them and to force them to do certain things. He must live now at a different pace. He must find new talents, new skills, new interests within himself. And he's often, during a period of a lifetime, denied these interests, turned away from them. He didn't have time for them, but now he needs to call upon them. And there's the problem of family. We need the love of family, the closeness of family. But we also recognize that our children need to be independent, and in our scattered world, they're often not around. And many during this age feel that their children are paying very little attention to them because they're caught up in their own lives and they're not paying court as perhaps we might like them to be. It's a difficult time, this entrance into age. For some, it comes very early, in the 50s. For some, it doesn't come until the 70s. But whenever it comes, it requires a new awareness of self, a new response to certain challenges. We've got to pull something out of ourselves which we didn't have to pull up to that point. We've got to learn to live with a new flair for the period of life which is ours. And that's a challenge which everyone faces, and we can face it then only with the skills and the energy and in the condition of life which is now available to us. So first came the study of childhood and then the study of age. And it's only in very recent months, really, or years perhaps, a few years, that people have begun to study adulthood, to assume that there are certain patterns of behavior, patterns of challenge, crisis in adulthood, which we share. Up to now, adulthood was measured either physically, as that time we came into our full stature, we assumed responsibility for our lives, and it was those 30 or 40 years in which we were responsible and full of energy and capable and independent. And it was assumed, I suspect, largely that during that period of time, each life was unique. Each person had his unique opportunity, his unique set of talents, his will, his level of energy, his drive, and each one went his own way. Oh, certain minor things happened to us during that period. We lost a little bit of our hair. We came to depend more on experience than we did on the constant process of learning. As we achieved in life, we learned to relax a little bit more. But by and large, it was assumed until recent times that adulthood was a kind of long middle period of independence and of uniqueness. And so when we look back into the tradition, we find either that adulthood is defined physically, it's full growth, or legally. Jewish life, for instance, defines the gadol, the adult, simply as the one who is fully liable under both the civil and criminal law, as the one who is fully responsible for his actions, as the one who is obligated to abide by all of the duties and responsibilities of the mitzvot, of the commandments. I picked up a typical human development text the other day by Dr. Theodore Liz, who is the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Yale Medical School. And I looked at the book for a number of reasons, but I happened to glance at the table of contents. And I recognized that of the 580 pages in the book, the 23 chapters in the book, only one was devoted to the middle years, to adulthood, only 19 pages of the 590. Somehow there was a lot to say about childhood. There's a lot to say about adolescence. There's a lot to say about age. But almost nothing, he felt, had to be said about adulthood. But what we're discovering now is that adulthood, too, has a certain pattern to it. We're only beginning to explore that pattern, but it's there. And what I'd like to do this morning is to raise to you, with you, two common moments which all adults pass through, one in the early years of adulthood and one in the middle years of adulthood. And to suggest, at most or at least, to suggest that as we pass through these, the recognition that we must pass through them is in fact part of the way in which we successfully adapt ourselves to them. In the early years, a person finds himself adult, not when he's put behind his toys and has finally reached the size where his tailor will never have to measure him again, at least not for the next 10 or 20 years. He becomes adult when he finds himself, when he emerges as a fully developed personality. Adolescence is the time in which we try to find ourselves, in which we push away peer pressures, family pressures, the conditioning of our world, and try to find our way, to do our thing, to discover who we are. It's a terrible time. It's the time in which the butterfly is emerging from the cocoon. The adolescent is moving here and there almost fitfully, erratically, it seems, from the outside, struggling to find himself. There's an identity crisis. And when he emerges, if in fact he successfully emerges as an I, as a self, as a rather fully developed person, then he's full of competence and full of energy and full of drive and full of thrust, and he moves ahead through the early 20s, the middle 20s, with great confidence. He knows where he's going. He's determined to get there. He has all the energy, all the ability, all the quickness of intellect to get there. But he also emerges from adolescence encapsulated in himself. He's had to work so hard to find himself that he's had to push others away. Family, real friendship. He has a lot of companions, people who throng around, but very few real friends. He's full of drive, of energy, of sexual drive, if you will, full of lust. But he has very little chance or willingness to involve himself deeply in love, in the tender human patient relationships. And the real crisis of early adulthood is the crisis between this sense of self and a desire to involve oneself intimately in the life of others. It's the crisis of finding our own humanity. Do we become human? Or do we remain simply an individual, an I, driving, driven, seeking some goal, which we assume will bring us happiness? Now, not all who marry and who establish a family put their eyes aside and establish these relationships. The existence of a family is not proof that the individual has, in fact, intimately woven his life into the life of others. It's not easy to do. It requires quite a struggle. It requires quite a gift of self, because you make yourself dependent upon the security and the success and the health of others. There's a story in the Bible which reminds me constantly of this challenge of early maturity. It's the story of Jacob when he comes back towards his brother's clan from whom he's fled 14 years before. You remember Jacob and Esau had this terrible battle when they were adolescents over the birthright. And Jacob undid his brother, and he fled from his brother's well-placed anger. And he went to live with his uncle Laban, and he worked there for 14 years, and he acquitted himself fairly well. And in the process, the adolescent became a man. And he came to recognize that he couldn't live away, by himself, alone. He wanted to be reunited with his family, with his brother. And so he comes back towards Hebron, where the family clan exists. And when he gets to a certain stream, the river Yabok, he goes to sleep. And he has that terrible dream during the night in which he fights with himself. He fights with the angel. Has he the courage to cross the river or not? I suspect there's hardly a man or a woman who, as they face the gift of self into marriage, has not struggled the long night. Should I really give myself to another, wholly and completely? Am I willing to accept the responsibilities, the obligations of love, of patience, of intimacy, which I'm undertaking? It's not an easy challenge that we face during those early years. But if we face it, and give ourselves in love and become human, then life for the rest of our lives has a certain texture to it. We're more open. We're more empathetic. There are others around us who help us, who sustain us. And the older we get, the more we come to recognize the rich blessing that friendship and love and intimacy and family really are. Now, that challenge of early adulthood is a challenge faced by all. It's a challenge which is particularly difficult in this generation because now there is the option not to give oneself in love. Often people took a family because that was expected of them. And then 10, 15, 20 years later, they came to appreciate the fact that they had a family. But today, many are choosing to walk alone, not to wrestle the long night with this need to open oneself up, to live for longer periods of time within the capsule, within the envelope of self. And the longer you live within it, the harder it gets to break out of it. And middle age and age can be awfully lonely when you live only within the narrow parameters of yourself. And as we move on through adulthood, we come to another period during the middle years. It's a period in which our senses become dimmed a little bit. We have to put on and take off our glasses. We begin to recognize that we run out of energy late in the day. We begin to recognize that we can't wrestle our children to the floor or always keep up with our grandchildren. Whatever the signals, we come to a period of life where suddenly we recognize that the future is foreshortened. That is to say that as many doors of opportunities were once open to us are no longer open to us. We may have great success in our profession, in our marriages, in the things that we do. But one of the things that keeps us young is a sense, well, if I don't like it, I can chuck it. I can do something else. And it becomes more and more difficult to say, well, I can simply drop this and go back to law school. I can drop that and start another business. There comes a time in life, and the word that some sociologists have created for it is middlescence, like adolescence, middlescence. There comes a period in the middle years, the late 40s, early 50s, sometimes early 40s, sometimes later in the 50s, when suddenly there is another crisis of personality. There have been physical changes. For the woman, they're well known. The man, we think, also goes through many of these similar kinds of changes. There are many changes that are physiological, and there are certain changes which are psychological. Suddenly, the things that gave us great happiness, great excitement and exhilaration in the younger years, no longer give us as much excitement and exhilaration. The taste is not as sharp. Suddenly, we recognize what Ecclesiastes said long, long ago. I made me great works, I builded me homes, I planted me gardens and parks. I was great and successful. Whatever my eye desired, I kept not from it. Verily, then I looked at all the work of my hands, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind. That sense of ennui, not despair, that sense that life is simply, oh, shadowed, lying heavy on us, leads people during these years of middlescence to do some very strange and erratic things, the most desperate of which is to try to recapture youth. This is a time when many marriages break up. As one or the other of the partners in the marriage says, if I don't do it now and find somebody who's young and who'll keep me alive, I'll never recapture my youth. It's a time when many people turn away from some business or from profession for a so-called second career. Somehow they're going to find zest, excitement in doing something new that they've not done before. And they may need that change. At the same time, many of these changes are impulsive and erratic and not well thought through. A product really of that Sturm und Drang of middlescence, of that sense that we're wrestling with ourselves to try and accept what is ultimately unacceptable. The fact that we are aging and the fact that there's now less time between where we are now and our death than between our birth and our pleasant present place. And during this period of time, there can be great frustration. Sometimes it shows in anger towards one's family. Sometimes it shows up in anger, bitterness towards one's employer. It can show up in many ways. But everyone, in a sense, goes through it. At some point, we have to come to grips with our mortality. It's for this reason that congregations are composed to a large degree of middle-aged and older people. Because one of the solutions to middle age, to this crisis of middle-aged, is to come back to the age-old wisdom of the religious tradition, a wisdom which sees the possibility in every age, a wisdom which says you should never have believed that you could change the world, make it over, transform it. You can live and you can live well and you can be part of the long parade of human civilization. And people have found dignity and possibility at every moment of life. But don't think so much of yourself. Don't vaunt yourself so highly. It's a time when people find their faith in God very comforting because it gives them again the long view at a time when, given just our own lives, the future has been foreshortened. Now, there are no clear guidelines given to any of us by the simple fact we can describe certain common developmental problems which we will face, certain times in life when there will be emotional and personal crises. But at least the knowledge that they're there, that to a certain degree we can know what's ahead, ought to give to people of ability, bright people, to you and to me, a warning and a sense of possibility. If we face whichever one of these stages that we face, ought we not now to be making preparations, planning, doing the things which can be done with the skills and the level of energy that will be ours at a given point? Making plans which are not only financial, not only familial, which are quite personal. If we're facing age, ought we not now be making plans that will allow us to unfold during a retirement rather than to face the desperate void when we get up every morning and say, what can I do today? And if we're facing ahead the problem of middle-aged, ought we not to be developing some philosophy which will allow us to see the possibilities of a time when our families are grown and we have relative success in our chosen undertakings, and we have the time to reach out to the community, to support its institutions, to work for its betterment. Well, we can reach out to, in so many ways, with the skills which are ours, to serve. You don't have to always throw over a profession or a business in order to find new opportunities, new challenges in life. They're all about you. And if we're coming out of adolescence and moving into the early ages of adulthood, ought we not to recognize that one of the real challenges to us will be our ability to break open the shell of self which we have so carefully built and to do not only our thing, but the thing which will involve us with those worth being involved with, those whom we love. There's a new possibility to life because of our knowledge of these stages of human development, for those who are wise, and for those who will plan. Life is not easy. And if this whole new science of human development can teach us anything, it's this: that at no stage of our life can we say, I have developed my talents, I now have those skills and those capacities which I need to have, which will take me the whole way. There are a lot of people, I'm afraid, who once they develop their skills, once they gain their professional license, once they mature into the things that they undertake vocationally or professionally or within the circle of their family responsibilities, they feel that nothing more, no other development will ever be demanded of them. They've done all that needs to be done to prepare themselves for life. And that's simply not true. Because so many different requirements, emotional and psychological and personal and creative and skilled requirements, are demanded of us at other stages of life. You may be totally successful as a doctor or a lawyer or a businessman or a volunteer worker in your community and totally unsuccessful when retirement comes, because the one set of skills are not identical with the others. You may be wonderfully successful with your employees in your business and totally unsuccessful within the context of real friendship and of close family ties. You may be able to think through a problem of budget, a problem of financing, all the problems of the day-to-day world, and totally incapable of thinking through and making an inventory of your own skills so you can develop these during the last years. The senses, the aesthetic senses, art, music, literature, writing, gardening, beauty, all of these, the friendship capacities, the patience, the sweetness, the openness, all the things that can carry us along those stages. Each of us is at another stage of life. And each of us has a very special set of talents, and none of us can determine exactly when we're going to move from stage to stage. But the future is there, and the future is no longer uncharted. There's some clear signs of what we're going to go through. Let a word to the wise be sufficient. Amen.